Ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. My name is Paul Wallace. I am here on behalf of the Department of Justice, and I represent the appellant in this case, the State of Delaware. Many times when I prepare for oral argument, I try not to work in what are legal cliches. But in this case, I simply could not help it. This case is one of the most bare-bones cases of form over substance that I believe one could see. What happened in this case was that Timothy Kelly was arrested in 1998. He was given a summons, criminal summons, to go to the Justice of the Peace Court. The very document that acts as an information in the Justice of the Peace Court, when a person is arrested for a misdemeanor and appears in our Justice of the Peace Court, that is the charging document. It is the information. There are no other documents filed. And it is on that very document that the case proceeds forward. Timothy Kelly ignored it. He instead decided not to appear, and a capias was issued for him. And 8 years later, he decided to appear. And then what he attempted to do was utilize what are fundamental rights, no doubt, fundamental right to a jury trial in criminal cases, which can only happen in this state by transferring that matter to the Court of Common Pleas, for the sole purpose of forcing the state into a court where an information, what we call, quote, an information, had to be filed, and the next day moved to dismiss that information. And I say this is form over substance because there is no doubt.
But that's not in the record. Was there testimony taken? How do you know his motive? How's that in the record?
Well, because on May 15th, Your Honor, the case was transferred. The case was transferred. On May 15th, the state filed the information. On May 16th, he moved to dismiss it. Perhaps that is not direct evidence, but it's pretty good circumstantial evidence as to what he was looking to do. Why else? Why not, if he had a valid claim of a statute of limitations claim, raise it in the Justice of the Peace Court? Because the Justice of the Peace Court doesn't use what they call informations as the charging documents. They use the complaint summons.
Maybe you wanted a law-trained judge to decide a complex legal issue.
That may be the case. However, why would he would force it to happen the day after he filed it? I mean, it's for the sole purpose of forcing the state to file what is otherwise termed an information. By the way, information really isn't defined in the statutes. And in fact, that's where the state suggests Lynch is extremely helpful in this regard.
Why do you say that the state was forced to file an information? You're relying on section, as I understand it, 5305.
Yes.
And that basically is the statute that you argue saves your case.
It does.
And the part of the statute that you contend saves your case basically provides, as a legal matter, that if there's an appeal from JP to Court of Common Pleas, the matter proceeds as if it had been originally filed, I gather, in the Court of Common Pleas by way of information.
Yes.
So you didn't have to file an information. Couldn't you have just relied in the real world on the statute that you're relying on now?
I would suggest in the real world that maybe the answer is two-part. In the real world, we could have tried. In the real world, the Court of Common Pleas judges would have told us, no, our rule says you file an information here. We won't proceed under unless you file an information under Rule 7. And many of the cases that the defense, in fact, cites, I'm sorry, the appellee cites in his brief, say exactly that. And by the way, as a matter of custom and practice, if a court wants the state to file a more formal document like an information, certainly that's up to the individual courts. The Justice of the Peace Court does not require it. And in fact, we never file informations in the Justice of the Peace Court, even though the rules provide for that.
Okay, so your answer is no, it wasn't legally necessary to file an information once there was an appeal. But unless you did so, the experience was that the Common Pleas Court would dismiss your case.
Yes, under 48B grounds. I mean, and the cases, those Court of Common Pleas cases that the appellee cites, basically are all 48B type cases. And again, the state is not saying that the Court of Common Pleas can't use 48B sanctions if the state doesn't file under Rule 7 consistent with their custom and their practice and their wish to have that more formalized document. What the state is saying is that under 5305, that is where the legislature made provision to ensure that once a case was filed in JP court, once a defendant did in fact wish to exercise his right to bring that matter to the Court of Common Pleas, that it would in fact move forward as if it had been originally filed in JP in the Court of Common Pleas by information.
Well, 205 has a broad application beyond traffic cases, and yes. Help me understand what the practices are in this instance. Let's assume someone's arrested on a charge with a felony and he's taken before the Justice of the Peace Court and bond is set and he posts it and then flees. All right, an indictment or information hasn't been filed. What is the practice of the Department of Justice, assuming his flight has taken him away towards the end of the statute of limitations period?
Generally, what would happen in that case, Your Honor, is the case would actually be intake to the Department of Justice, and we would determine whether we should file an indictment and a Rule 9 warrant.
And then you would do it if you wanted to prosecute the case or otherwise let it lapse.
Yes. We would screen the case to determine whether it should be prosecuted or not. But
is it your position then that, or do you concede that in that instance, if an indictment or information was not filed within the statute of limitations, and the person was later brought back in on a capias, that the prosecution would be barred?
Yes, it would be. And here's the reason. And I believe this is exactly why, you know, it's interesting that Judge Clark says, why didn't they put complaint? If they wanted to fix this problem, if they wanted to say a complaint was the same as an information, why not just say that when the legislature made a statutory change in 2006? That's because complaint means a couple of different things in Delaware practice. A complaint is the officer's complaint to get an arrest warrant. The state absolutely agrees that that is not sufficient to toll the statute of limitations, and there's good reason for that. There should be, because a police officer can get an arrest warrant and the person never has notice of it, never is arrested, and the arrest warrant sits out, he's gotten a complaint, the same type, the same wording of the thing used in misdemeanor case, in a misdemeanor case similar to this.
Statute would never run, is what you're saying.
Yes. And so what happens is, in that circumstance, that would be constitutionally violative. I mean, that is what the statute of limitations is all about, is giving a person fair notice that, in fact, they need to answer for charges. And in that circumstance, if they simply slid the word complaint into 205, that person wouldn't have that fair notice, and the state doesn't believe that to be correct. In this case, however, a complaint summons in misdemeanor cases like this acts much differently. Kelly had specific notice that he needed to answer for charges. That's what the statute of limitations is all about. That's why we have placed it into our law, and it's such a long-standing part of criminal law. He had those. He chose not to appear after he had it, and he was told to be summoned. That's why complaint, at least in Delaware parlance, shouldn't merely be slid in there, or it should not be included in the statutory language in that sense. That's why, to answer, I guess, Judge Clark's question, why it didn't happen.
But aren't there circumstances under which the AG's office files an information in either Court of Common Pleas or it was in the Court of Common Pleas and notice is never received by the named accused in the information? So why would that work differently than a complaint in the court?
But when a Rule 9, if an information is filed against a defendant in the Court of Common Pleas, then it is also either accompanied by a Rule 9 warrant or Rule 9 summons, which is at least sent to the defendant. It is, you know, there's an attempt to notify the person. It may not be, it may not be that it's actually the person may have fled or whatever, but at very least there's been an attempt by practice. It has to. whenever we file an information, we always file a Rule 9 summons or warrant, and there is an attempt that, that at least by mail goes to the defendant, well, if not
and,
in some other way.
You're telling us that the complaint and summons that's potentially filed in the JP court, there is no mailing to the defendant's last known address.
That's because it's given directly to him, like in Kelly's case. Kelly got the complaint and summons. If the court looks to the appendix, Kelly got the complaint and summons right there from the police officer and signed it. He knew which day he had to be there. That's what I'm saying. He has notice of the charges. He has the full charging document before him because that's how the complaint and summons works.
I'm trying to understand your distinction between a complaint and a complaint and summons, and therefore what is in fact the charging document in the JP court. In the best of all worlds, the statute would have said the charging document in any of our courts or words to that effect, and we wouldn't have this problem.
That's
the
true.
Problem we have, as I understand it, is generated by the reference solely to information and indictment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which leaves what at least the synopsis of Senate Bill 334 calls a loophole. And my question in that respect is, would I be erroneously speculating if I were to conclude that Senate Bill 334 was initiated by the Attorney General's office for the purpose of dealing with this problem? And with or without that premise, what significance does that statute have for the argument that you're making today?
First, the court would not be erroneous. Certainly the Attorney General's office had part in writing it and in doing that because it appeared that there were circumstances that it could address.
But you're arguing to us now that it really is superfluous because there really isn't a problem. You could have relied on Lynch, and we would have considered the complaint and summons in JP court to be the equivalent of an information or an indictment because they're all, in effect, charging documents. And they all, as the judge said in Lynch, should be treated the same. Anything else would be an anomaly. But how do we deal with the fact the legislature seems to think that there was a gap in time there where legislation was needed to correct the problem?
Well, I think, I mean, it's somewhat of a belt and suspenders type of situation.
How do we know that? We look at the face of the bill, we look at the previous statute, we look at the synopsis. How can you reach a conclusion other than the legislature that passed Senate Bill 334 believed there was a loophole or a void in the law that needed to be corrected, and every situation that preceded the enactment of that statute could have the anomalous result that happened here?
Well, I think that when the legislature acts, the problem is it's unclear. To use the synopsis of a bill that does not even address the other statutes which do address this situation, that's 5305. There's no knowledge, there's no mention of 5305, for instance, in Senate Bill 334 and how that interacts with 205. It appears that they were, and I believe they were, trying to ensure that there was some synergy and giving more guidance, really, than anything else than necessarily.
But it is true, isn't it, if Senate Bill 334 had not been enacted, we would be left with the question of do we adopt the analysis in Lynch, because that would have been the current state of the law. Which Lynch to me reads to say what you began with, and that is that it makes no sense to simply use the terminology of information indictment to foreclose the charging document in JP court, the complaint and summons, from being considered in the same way as an information and indictment. It's just a continuation of the same charge.
That's true.
Now it's complicated by Senate Bill 334.
And perhaps had Lynch been, I mean, a few years later, if they had changed 9902 to then say, look, the judiciary has pointed out to us that there's this troublesome language in our statute. They've, by judicial decision, at least ensured that what we may have missed doesn't go forward. In this case, the legislature acted first, in a way, to say it appears that that there may have been a weakness in our statute.
Yeah, I don't change 9902 suggests to me, anyway, that the legislature was content with Lynch, because we tend to assume, perhaps naively, that as we know what the legislature does, the legislature knows, or at least is informed by others, as to what we do. So no change to 9902 suggests, by inference, that the legislature is content with Lynch. Lynch, by analogy, would have solved this problem. But now we have Senate Bill 334 to deal with, which seems to suggest that the legislature thought that the law was in flux on this precise issue, and they needed to make a change. And now there's this black hole in the middle.
I guess my suggestion would be this, Your Honor. Whenever I heard that argument and I read that argument by the lower courts, I always thought to myself, it's kind of like holding subsequent remedial measures against somebody in a tort. When the legislature decides there's this weakness that we should take care of, that's not an admission that, in fact, Lynch shouldn't also have been applied to those cases that came before it. Instead, I suggest respectfully that it's good legislating. It's trying to ensure that the language is clear and that what may be an anomaly, an oversight, like Lynch said, that nobody ever really thought of because nobody would think that a full charging document used in one court when 5305 says it carries forward. Kelly's argument is this.
Mr.
Wallace. Once the information, I'm sorry.
Can he finish my
argument? Once Kelly's argument seems to be this. Once the information is filed in CCP, it erases the prior the proper commencement of the prosecution in this case.
Two quick questions about Section 5305.
Yes.
How did the lower courts deal with that statute, if at all?
They did not.
Okay. Second question. Even if 5305 has the effect that you say it does, does that get you home free? Isn't there another step in the analysis? That is to say, doesn't your argument implicitly assume that there's retroactivity?
Yes, but I think that's pretty clearly what 5305 is saying.
Pretty clearly?
I would suggest respectfully that when it says the matter shall proceed as though originating in the court by information filed, that what it is saying is we are taking what happened in JP court, the proper commencement of the prosecution, and it shall go forward. Now the rules of the Court of Common Pleas should apply, and if custom and practice says state filed information, we should do so. Right. If we don't do it in the right time, 48B may apply.
Did you want to save your 2.5 minutes?
I would, please. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Michael Abram on behalf of Timothy Kelly, the appellee. The state began stating that the charging document in the JP court is an information. It's not an information. It's a ticket. It's a summons. It's not an information. It does not have the same formality as a document produced by the Attorney General's office and signed by the Attorney General.
So Lynch was wrongly decided.
I think Lynch is a different situation. I think if you look at the history of Lynch, then Judge Chandler did, stating that this statute came from the federal section and did not consider a complaint because they don't appear in the federal system. Whereas in this case, I think you can say that the legislature considered complaints and chose not to do them.
So it wasn't, Lynch was correctly decided.
I think Lynch was correctly decided for what it was for. I mean, I think it was fairly obvious that the legislature did not, like I said, as Judge Chandler said, enact the statute to limit the state's rights of appeal. It did it to clarify and expand them, which I don't think is the case here. I think one of the problems you run into is if the state's argument that a complaint is the same, if you look at Superior Court Criminal Rule 3, it echoes Court of Common Pleas Rule 3, and it says that a case can be commenced it can be instituted by a complaint, by an indictment, by an information, when allowed, such as with a waiver at a preliminary hearing. If 205 is saying the same thing, that a complaint is the same as an information, then anybody who is ever arrested, given the rules in Superior Court and the rules of Court of Common Pleas, would never have their cases time barred, the statute of limitations would disappear for anyone ever arrested, period.
But doesn't 5305 deal with a transfer as opposed to a gap?
I think 5305, I think the key thing with 5305 is the title to begin with. It says bail and commitment. The title of this section is not the institution of cases in other court. I think that the sentence that comes up saying as originating in this court could have many meanings aside from the ones offered by the Attorney General's office. For example, like I said, I didn't write this law, I don't know, but for example, if language like that was not in there, a defendant could perhaps raise a double jeopardy claim and say, you had your shot at me in JP court, I moved it, you didn't convict me in JP court, here I am in CCP, this is a second trial on the same charges. So I think that there's other reasons for that statute to be in there, more specifically probably to leave bond on someone, so if the case transfers, the state doesn't have to do another warrant on them.
What's your view of the purpose of requiring an information in the Court of Common Pleas as opposed to simply transferring the complaint and summons?
I think, as some of the case law says, the formality of it, an officer writing a ticket on the side of the road does not have the same formality as the Attorney General filing an information, writing specifically
with
the charges.
Forget about the formality. The fact that the Attorney General looks at the complaint and summons as it comes up from JP court, doesn't the Attorney General have the discretion to decide whether to file an information or not at that point?
I think that they clearly do. And I think that the Court of Common Pleas, like I said, case law says you've got to tell us that we're going forward. I think it's the same analogy would be to if a case went through a preliminary hearing and the Court of Common Pleas found that there was probable cause, so the case could go to Superior Court as instituted, but if they don't file an information or an indictment in Superior Court, the case doesn't move forward.
Whether it happens or not, the public policy is that the AG's office would scrutinize the complaint and summons that came from the JP court, determine that there was reason to believe the crime had been committed by that person, then and only under those circumstances file an information, correct?
You would assume so. Otherwise, I don't know what the role of an information period would be. I don't think you'd need one in any court.
Well, the other role is just as a matter of rote. Whatever comes up from JP court goes to a secretary's desk, it's transferred to a piece of paper that's called an information, and then it's filed as a matter of routine in the Court of Common Pleas without any scrutiny by a deputy attorney general. Should we assume that that's the way it actually works and that that's what was intended?
I think that maybe you should assume that. I don't know that there are a whole lot of cases that are transferred from the JP court to the Court of Common Pleas.
Is there anything in the record that explains the purpose of filing an information, whether or not there is probable cause scrutiny by the Attorney General rather than by a police officer or a civilian complainant in JP court? Anything to suggest that there's greater import to the filing of an information in the Court of Common Pleas than there is to the simple transfer of a complaint and summons, wording from the complaint and summons to a piece of paper that calls itself an information?
I would say in this case there isn't anything, but I think in certain other cases, as some of the cases that were...
Now, I'm asking you what the record shows.
In this case?
Yeah.
In this case, there is no record. It was transferred. And, by the way, to answer the question from before, the reason it was transferred originally was because this case, Mr. Kelly came to me when Mr. Kelly went to renew his license in California, and they said, you have a capias from you in Delaware. You cannot renew your license. By transferring the case from the JP court to the Court of Common Pleas, the capias
is
lifted.
I'm not sure how relevant motive is or whether that's motive is, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, apparent in the record in any event. I think what we're trying to focus on is what does the statutory language mean when it makes reference to information and indictment? What's the significance of the Lynch cases by analogy, if an analogy is fair? Superior Court seemed to think that it was, even though it chose not to follow it. And what's the significance of Senate Bill 334 being enacted and the impact on the timing of your client's election to go to the Court of Common Pleas? And then finally, in my mind, trying to figure out why the legislature would refer to information in indictment and not charging document or not include complaint and summons
in the language. Is there a rationale for it?
Well, I think that the reason that they don't use the term charging document in there is because they want the Attorney General to look at it. They don't want any police officer to be able to charge anyone anywhere with anything, and the statute toll right there. As I stated before, in reviewing the Superior Court rules, as well as the Court of Common Pleas rules, it says a case can be instituted. It doesn't say the prosecution commences upon the filing of an information. I mean, upon the filing of a complaint, because otherwise anyone who was ever arrested, the statute of limitations would disappear. They would be gone. You could be arrested one time or something. Like I said, the state win a preliminary hearing, choose never to take it to Superior Court, but the statute would have been told because it was instituted that rule.
You would agree, would you not, that whenever a capias issues for someone who fails to appear, or a bench warrant or a Rule 9 summons, whatever, if the person has noticed that they're to appear and they fail to appear under virtually any rational circumstance, the statute of limitation is told.
Yes.
Isn't that fair?
Yes.
Why is this why would the legislature intend this to be an exception?
Because I think the legislature wants the Attorney General's office to look at it. If the Attorney General's office looks at it, as it could have done in this case at any time in those 2 years, and filed an information either in the JP court where it's permitted, or in the Nolly Pross and proceeded to the Court of Common Pleas and filed information, we wouldn't be here. The Attorney General's office either did not look at it or chose just not to file information. We can't assume one or the other.
And well, how would the Attorney General's office know to do anything if no one had made an election until after the statute of limitations had putatively run?
Well, it would seem to me that the prudent
plan.
Are they
supposed to file a capias within supposed to file an information without an election within 18 months of summons and complaint?
Well, the prudent thing would be is if anyone capiased at the JP court, file an information on them in the JP court. The Attorney General's office should be immediately aware of a capias, especially in a DUI.
When information's ever filed in the JP court?
They can be.
I didn't say that. That wasn't my question. I don't know that they can or can't be, but when in your career have you ever seen an information filed in the JP court? It's not the charging document. By custom, by practice, is it?
Not typically, no. But it can be. And if it was done, we would not have this discussion here today. There's nothing.
It seems an expensive prophylactic for JP court criminal prosecutions, doesn't it, to file information?
Only if there's a capias. I would assume that a relatively small number of cases brought by summons end up with a capias for the person not showing up there.
The statutory framework, once someone is charged with a complaint and summons, and it is the charging document, they don't appear in a capias issues. There's no contemplation that the information will be filed anywhere until someone elects to go to the Court of Common Pleas, right?
No, I would disagree. As the state said,
you'd have a charging document in JP court, the summons and complaint, and then on top of it you would file an information. What, would you nolly-pross the summons and complaint on which the capias is issued and then file an information? Otherwise you'd have two separate charging documents.
Well,
does that make any sense?
I think if you wanted to act the way the legislature intended, which was to make sure the Attorney General looked at these tickets to make sure that it would keep going forward.
But the legislature never intended for the AG to look at it until someone elected to go to the more expensive jury trial before a law-trained judge in the Court of Common Pleas. Then they want the AG to look at it because the Court of Common Pleas has thousands of cases, and they want to determine which one should go to trial and which one shouldn't at that stage. They let the police and the JP courts generally take care of the complaint and summons level traffic violations and unclassified misdemeanors. Why in the world would they want the AG screening every complaint and summons for which a capias had issued and determining whether to issue an information at that point?
Well, I would say that in this case, the Attorney General's office does have a deputy in the JP court that handles all DUI cases. So they would have looked at this case and chose not to file an information. It might be a different case in, I don't know, a speeding or a running a red light, but in DUI cases, they do look at them while they're in the JP court.
But is it the practice to file an information for DUI cases?
Not necessarily, not if they stay in the JP
court. But when you say not necessarily, When have you ever seen the AG's office file an information when a complaint and summons is already issued in the JP court?
I can't recall one.
Mr. Abrams, let's get back to Section 5305. That appears to be the linchpin of Mr. Wallace's appeal. The problem we have is that that issue, that argument was not addressed by the lower courts. So my question to you is, what is, you know, how do we deal with that? I mean, it seems to be a complete answer to the limitations problem, if applicable.
Well, I would say that there is no retroactive element in this. It does not say it will proceed as originating, you know, in this case, 8 years ago. And I think that
well, it does certainly seems to have a strong inference or implication that there's retroactivity. You're saying it applies, but it's not retroactive for limitations purposes?
I'm saying I don't know how it applies. I'm saying that with the heading of bail and commitment proceedings and the essential parts of this section being what appears to me to keep bail on someone that moves from one court to the other.
I seem to recall that there is a time period under which someone must elect to go to the Court of Common Pleas.
It's any time before
trial. Does 5305 contemplate that time period being met or not met? Does it matter?
I don't think it contemplates it. I think that, like I said, the entire purpose, noting from the heading to subsection B afterwards.
Well, am I correct that you can't just sit in JP court and elect whenever you want to go to the Court of Common Pleas? There's a time period under which you're supposed to elect after you appear in the JP court.
The rule says that you can do it any day before the trial.
Okay.
That's the rule. In this case,
so there's no statutory appeal period.
I don't think
or I'm, election period. Or
no, no, there isn't. It's any time before the day of trial.
Okay.
Is what the rule says.
But to answer my question, if I understand the answer correctly, you're saying that we should interpret Section 5305 narrowly, simply by reference to the caption, that is the title in the Delaware Code that appears before the text of the statute.
Well, I would say that 205G is extremely clear when it says indictment or information. And to take 5305, which appears to be a statute on bail, and to use that to override a clear statute as well as
some statute is overriding the other. That's 205 either overrides 5305 or vice versa. Or they could be read together, could they not?
I don't think they could be read together.
Well, isn't that the general charge to us as an appellate court? To try to read apparently conflicting statutes in harmony if they can logically be read that way? Isn't that the general rule of statutory construction?
I would agree. I, however, don't believe that there's any gray area in 205G. Lynch, I believe, then Judge Chandler, was dealing with a situation where the statute was taken from federal law and this situation would not have been contemplated, and he assumed that since it's limited instead of expanding, that they must have intended this. In this section here, as well as with the Senate bill that came afterwards, they could have just changed it to charging document. They chose not to. They recognized the loophole that has been used, and they said, well, we want to correct that, but we still want it to be an information or indictment. We don't want it to change. So I think that they can be conflicting, but to take 5305, which I said I interpret as being something about bail,
I don't know
override.
What that means, to be something about bail.
Well,
I mean, state in a coherent sentence or paragraph how we're to write an opinion in which we interpret Section 5305 in a way that's consistent with the result that was reached here.
Well, I don't – I think that the purpose of that section, from what I read it, is to say that bail will stay on somebody who goes from the JP court to the Court of Common Pleas. To expand that, to use the last line to say that it began in that court, I think it goes too far.
Well, I mean, if that's what it's all about, then why even have the sentence that provides that the matter shall proceed as if it had been originally by information. I'm paraphrasing, of course. I mean, what does that have to do with bail?
Dex said the only reason that I believe it could have meant was, say, for the potential of someone making an argument at double jeopardy saying that you had me in J.P. court and I'm here in court of common pleas. So if the statute says it started in court of common pleas, you wouldn't have that argument.
Well, tell me what the words the matter means as they appear in Section 5305 if it doesn't mean the case to be tried. What is the matter?
Well, I've noticed when I looked at this that there's, as in like the term commencing, the matter, it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing at different points. Like I said, the rules in JP court, I mean in CCP and Superior Court say instituting, as in like the beginning of a proceeding, like an arrest of someone, whereas commencing prosecution is not the same thing as instituting the matter.
Well, the matter, though, that's referred to in 5305 is the accused election to be tried by the Court of Common Pleas, isn't it? Isn't that the matter to which it refers? Not the setting of bail, but the election to be tried. In other words, the trial in the Court of Common Pleas. And it says that the trial in the Court of Common Pleas shall proceed as though originating in the court by information filed. And the court there means the justice of the peace court, doesn't it?
Well, I think what separates it and makes it different is that as the state conceded in their facts in this brief, they were required to file an information in the Court of Common Pleas. So I don't think that this statute just makes it go in and start as an information.
Well, at least one way of reading the statute is to suggest that you change the form when you set bail in JP court for someone who's elected to be tried in the Court of Common Pleas to assure they will indeed appear for their trial in the Court of Common Pleas. Then when they get to the Court of Common Pleas, after having elected to be tried there, the matter proceeds as though it had originated in the JP court by information. Why? Because information happens to be the charging document in the Court of Common Pleas for the trial that the defendant elected. So it sends, at least in one reading, a message that don't be elevating form over substance here. We recognize that the charging document changes, but it's going to proceed just as if there had been an information originally filed in JP court. And that solves the statute of limitations problem.
But that's contrary to the practice in the Court of Common Pleas. As the cases we cited in our brief, the Court of Common Pleas wants an information filed. The Court of Common Pleas does not recognize 5305.
I don't think anything about 5305 suggests that there won't be an information file. It says it proceeds as if there had been an information originally in the JP court, and the charging document is whatever the Court of Common Pleas wants it to be. I mean, that's one way to read it. It may not be the correct way. It may not be a way that gets three votes, but it's one way to read it. Your time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be very brief, less than 2.5 minutes, I hope.
Can you clarify one thing for me?
Yes.
The argument that you're making now about 5303 and 5305, that was raised directly in the Superior Court and not addressed.
Yes.
There's no argument that you waived it.
No, it was raised in the Superior Court, Your Honor. And in fact, when Judge Graves sets forth the arguments by the state, he notes that we made that precise argument. I cannot tell the court why he went directly to the synopsis of 334 and what he believed its effect on Lynch. Mr. Chief Justice, the state is asking the court to do exactly what Your Honor had noted, and that is sometimes when there are seemingly some conflict between statutes that we try to put them together and make one harmonious reading of it all. I'd suggest that if Senate Bill 334 did anything, it simply made the harmony greater. And that was all that the legislature was seeking to do. And that is being responsible and saying, when you can put it down in black and white and make it easier for everyone to determine exactly what needs to be done, that it is doing that. But when you look at 205, when you look at 5303, 5305, what we are saying is that in the circumstance of this case, where the charging document, by custom and practice for years, at least we know 20 years, many more than that.
Some of us think 37.
Has been the use of complaint and summonses in the Justice of the Peace Court to carry forward the prosecution. And in my experience, and perhaps I'm sure in Your Honor's experience, nobody's ever seen an information file in the JP Court, at least in modern history.
Well, to follow up on yes. the Chief Justice's question earlier, where there is a transfer or an election to go from the Justice of the Peace Court to the Court of Common Pleas, I gather that at that point there is independent review of the charging document by the Attorney General's office.
I'd like to say, yes, I'd like to say it's as thorough as we could make it.
But there is some level of review.
Yes. I mean, we look at the ticket, we look at the information, and then we make a decision as to whether to go forward. Some we don't.
The concern, I think, that was that implicit in the Chief Justice's question, and what I'm asking you is there any pre-election review by the Attorney General, or is there not, because the only time that it comes to the attention of the Attorney General is when there is an election?
It is only when the election is made to have it in the Court of Common Pleas, except in those rare circumstances where we're prosecuting in the Justice of Peace Court.
I know your time is up, but I have another question.
Yes.
At least the red light's on. And
I've still got but we're counting up.
Comment by your counsel, by your colleague, that there is, for DUI cases, a Deputy Attorney General in the JP Court. And it's possible for the Deputy Attorney General there to look at the charge and document, complaint and summons, even before election, by inference from what he said, and decide whether to proceed by information or whether to send information in another sense to the AG in the Court of Common Pleas, who will review the charge that comes up. Is that, as a practical matter, going on?
I would suggest that when we have reviewed the case for JP prosecution and then he elects to go to the Court of Common Pleas, it is. Capious cases? No. And there are many more capious cases, I believe, than counsel might believe. The state simply, the Office of the Attorney General does not have the resource in a court that we normally don't prosecute in to look to see who capious and then review their case and determine whether we should file an information. First of all, the JP court would revolt. They, by custom and practice, don't take informations. They're not even equipped to do it.
Yeah, I'm sure Justice Ridgely will straighten me out on this, but I have a recollection that the Superior Court at least once a year sits down with the Deputy Attorney Generals in that particular county and goes through a capious review and determines which capiouses should remain and which cases will be dismissed. Does that happen in JP court on outstanding capious?
Actually, we're getting more aggressive about doing that, Your Honor, and we are doing a court-wide review. And that's been ongoing. I'd say we've raised our level of activity in that in about the last 18 months.
And is there any ongoing practice of removing cases by information or indictment from JP court? Or
no.
Is that not done anymore?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel will take the case under advisement and recess.